The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU School of Business. Annual sponsor is the Idaho Humanities Council. The moderator for today's forum is Catherine Himes.
Welcome to today's City Club Forum. I'm Dr. Catherine Himes, director of the McClure Center for Public Policy Research at the University of Idaho and moderator and chair of today's forum. I would like to welcome our radio listeners to today's forum. Joining us over Boise State Public Radio, I would like to thank City Club of Boise media partners, Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI, the Idaho Statesman, and Pepper Shock Media. I would also like to thank the City Club of Boise Forum Series sponsors Micron, AARP Idaho, Echelon Group, and St. Luke's Health System. Following our speakers' presentations today, there will be an opportunity to respond to your questions. There are cards at each of your tables. If you have a question, please fill out one of the cards and hold it up so that we can pick it up and bring it to the front. Criminal justice reform has attracted significant attention at the federal level with the passage and signing of the Formerly Incarcerated Reenter Society Transformed Safely Transitioning Every Person Act, also known as the First Step Act. The First Step Act marks the culmination of a 10-year bipartisan, bicameral push for reform. Some argue that this represents the most substantive federal justice reform in at least a generation. Many states across the nation are exploring opportunities to support criminal justice reform through legislative and executive branch action. Idaho's legislature is quite engaged on this topic. For example, on Wednesday, the Senate Judiciary Committee voted unanimously to extend the Special Committee on Criminal Justice Reinvestment Oversight until 2023. I am delighted to introduce our speakers. We have three today, so I'll introduce each speaker, and then they'll give brief remarks, and then I'll move on to the next speaker, and so forth. First, I'm delighted to introduce University of Idaho College of Law Professor Aliza Cover. Professor Cover teaches the topics of criminal law, constitutional criminal procedure, and the death penalty. Her scholarship focuses on public participation in the criminal justice system and the role of society's evolving standards of decency in the Supreme Court's death penalty jurisprudence. Professor Cover's most recent scholarship has been published or is forthcoming in the Yale Law Journal Forum, the George Washington Law Review, the Indiana Law Review, and the Harvard Civil Rights, Civil Liberties Law Review. Professor Cover has received her law degree from Yale, and among other activities after graduating from law school, she clerked for the late Judge Stephen Reinhart on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Thank you, Professor Cover.
It is such an honor to be here talking to you all about criminal justice reform, which is a very important and timely issue, and with two such respected Idaho legislators. And I'm really looking forward to hearing from them and getting their perspectives about possibilities for reform here in Idaho. My plan is to give a quick summary of where we've been as a country, where we are now, and where we're going, and how the First Step Act fits into this trajectory. So first, where have we been as a country over the past 40 or so years? We've seen the rise of mass incarceration, both on a state level and at a federal level. But because there are so many more people incarcerated at the state level, the state impact far outpaces the federal one. So here are just a few statistics about the scope of incarceration in our country today and where we used to be. So the United States has the highest rate of incarceration in the world, and we have the highest rate of incarceration for women in the world. Today, there are nearly 2.2 million people in jails and prisons, whereas in 1980, there were about 500,000. So that's between a 4- and 5-fold increase in our prison population. At the end of 2016, there were more than 6.6 million people under the supervision of the criminal justice system. So that includes people on probation and parole as well. These numbers have been declining since 2008, but they're still quite high. And the scope of the problem is much bigger in the state level rather than the federal government. So there are more than 10 times more people incarcerated in the states versus in the federal prisons. And this mass incarceration has really had a disparate impact racially. According to 2016 data, African American men were incarcerated at 6 times the rate as white men, Latino men incarcerated at 2.5 times the rate of white men. And this system, of course, is also very expensive. To provide a public defender for every single person coming into the system, to keep all these people housed in prisons, requires quite a lot of money at a time when states and the federal government are feeling constraints. So what is the cause of mass incarceration? There are a number of different factors, and scholars debate what the causes are. I'll talk about 3 possible reasons. First, it's about what legislatures are doing. Second, it's about what prosecutors are doing. And third, it's about what the Supreme Court is not doing. So particularly in the 1980s and 1990s, there was a real bipartisan push for harsher criminal policies on and legislation. And for decades, it was really a wise move politically to be tough on crime during elections. We saw the rise of mandatory minimums for drug offenses. We saw the rise of 3 strikes laws, both federally and at the state level. And all of this together created a lot of situations in which there were very harsh punishments for nonviolent offenses as well as violent offenses. At the same time, that legislative push gave prosecutors very powerful tools to exercise leverage over defendants who are exercising who are deciding whether or not to go to trial or to plead guilty. Today's criminal justice system is not a system of trials. It's a system of pleas, of guilty pleas. About 94% of state convictions and about 97% of federal convictions are the result of guilty pleas rather than trials. And the expansion of criminal laws allows prosecutors to sort of say that they will bring harsher charges, right, if defendants decide to go to trial. And it gives a lot of opportunities for more incarceration of people who are facing criminal trials. At the same time, the Supreme Court has essentially left this arena to the discretion of legislatures and prosecutors. The court has read the Eighth Amendment, which is the protection against cruel and unusual punishments. The court has read the Eighth Amendment narrowly to allow for a wide range of practices, such as life imprisonment for a series of nonviolent felonies, for example. And has authorized and given discretion to prosecutors to use that leverage and to say that somebody might get charged as a recidivist, for example, and face life in prison unless they plead guilty. So at bottom, courts have deferred to legislatures, and legislatures have given really powerful tools to prosecutors to put people in jail. Now, in recent years, there have been varying different reforms that have been responsive to some of this, the scope of this problem of mass incarceration. And I'm just going to mention a few of them because there are a lot. But importantly, these reform efforts have largely happened outside of Congress. And that's part of what makes the First Step Act so important, because previous reforms were really not housed there. At the state and local level, there has been sentencing reform efforts in various different states. There's also been a smart on crime movement where prosecutors are saying that they will not just be tough on crime, but rather make policy decisions about where prosecution is appropriate. We have recently seen bail reform. Cash bail is a system where people need to pay money either through a bail bonds company or to the court directly in order to get out of jail pretrial. And that results in a lot of people, including nonviolent low-level offenders, being stuck in jail because they can't afford bail. And so we have seen different reform efforts targeting that system. California just recently eliminated cash bail entirely, moving to a risk assessment process instead. We've also seen marijuana legalization across the country. Now 10 states have, and plus the District of Columbia, allow recreational marijuana. 33 states have legalized medical marijuana. And recently, in 2018, in the recent election, Florida enfranchised over 1 million felons who were previously ineligible to vote in a really bipartisan effort. So against that background, very, very quickly, why is the First Step Act important? It's really the first large effort at the national congressional level to deal with some of these policies. And it's the first, and it's this major effort that is impressively bipartisan, right? So in a time of enormous gridlock in our country, we have seen a real effort from both sides of the aisle to come together and reach consensus about these types of issues. And I think that's really exciting for the future for states who really need to take the lead from here, because there is such a small population of people who are in prison federally, and the states is really where the action is in so many ways. It provides an exciting example for states that we can work together despite differences in opinions to have meaningful criminal justice reform. And maybe, I know I'm pretty much out of my time, so if people have further questions about sort of where Idaho is with respect to some of these issues, I'd be happy to chat more about that.
Thank you, Professor Cover. It is an honor, next, to introduce Senator Todd Lakey. Senator Lakey is serving his fourth term in the Idaho Senate and represents District 12. He serves as chairman of the Judiciary and Rules Committee and previously served as the majority caucus chairman. Senator Lakey was a deputy prosecuting attorney for Canyon County, a Canyon County commissioner, on the Magistrates Commission for the 3rd Judicial District, and on the Idaho Capital Crimes Defense Fund Board. Senator Lakey retired in 2017 after 20 years of service as an officer in the United States Army Reserve's Judge Advocate General Corps. Senator Lakey earned his bachelor's degree in international business from Brigham Young University and his doctorate in law from Lewis and Clark Northwestern School of Law. Please welcome Senator Lakey.
Thank you, Catherine, and appreciate the opportunity to be with everybody this afternoon. The Justice Reinvestment Initiative, or JRI as I'll refer to it as I'm speaking today, started in Idaho a number of years ago, and it resulted in some significant legislation in 2014. And the idea was to address our growing prison population and the costs that were associated with that. And the legislation made a number of changes in the process, but also incorporated matrices and risk assessments to help decision makers, judges, probation and parole officers, corrections officials make decisions regarding the process and the individuals that are involved in the process. But as our Chief Justice, Roger Burdick, said in our State of the Judiciary that he gave to the legislature this year, he said, JRI's been a mixed bag. As far as the outcomes and results that we've seen. Some good, some not so good. A couple of years ago, we had some folks that were released that committed some pretty serious crimes, and so we made some adjustments. I look at it kind of like a machine or a process, where we put it in place and then we watch it. And if we need to tighten a bolt here or loosen a screw there or add a piece or take away a piece, we do that as we observe it over time. It's not something you just put in place and let go. Our new director of the Department of Corrections, Director T. Walt, said that JRI has accomplished the goal that those that we have in our prison system are really the most serious offenders at this point. There's kind of an urban myth out there that our prisons are full of low-level personal drug users. That's just not the case. Idaho does have one of the lowest crime rates in the country, and that's wonderful from my perspective as a legislator and as a father and a grandfather. But we also have one of the highest incarceration rates in the country. And with that, I think there's a correlation. You know, we have a safer community because we incarcerate more people, but there's a cost to that. And is that really the approach you want to take? For me, the first and highest priority is always and always will be public safety. I think I keep that as my highest priority, but we work on the incarceration system and try to make sure that we're accomplishing the goals of the JRI, which is, are we putting the right people in the system? Are we letting the right people out? And then are we really trying to help them not come back into the system? All of those aspects, the inputs and those that are in there and those that are out, I don't have enough time to talk about all of them. I'm going to talk more about those folks that are out, but I've worked on public defense reform over the years and as I've served as a legislator, and there's some other opportunities still to go. But I want to focus my comments on helping those once they're released from the system. Right now, 70% of those that are in our prison system are there because they failed or violated probation or parole. It's 75% if you count those that have failed on a rider. And a rider is a 180-day kind of intensive program that they can go through, and if they're successful, they're not committed to the Department of Corrections. So if we make just a 25% improvement in that rate, we don't have any need for out-of-state beds in Idaho. So I think we have a lot of opportunity there. And I want to talk about some of the specifics. We need to give our probation and parole officers more opportunity to be successful. Representative Wintrow sits on the Joint Finance Committee that provides funding, and we appreciate some of the work they've done. We had a report that came out last year that said we need 30 more probation and parole officers. But our new governor, Governor Little, and our new director, Director Tewalt, asked for 17 probation and parole officers with the idea that we're going to change how they do business and how they perform, and we're going to help them be more effective rather than just adding more to do what we're already doing. Our probation and parole officers, as we've looked at it, are spending too much time doing data entry and performing UAs. Those are things that can be better handled by administrative staff. We need to have our probation and parole officers engaged with those that they're supervising. That's what they're trained to do, and help those people be more effective. That includes increasing options for those probation and parole officers, from electronic monitoring, more opportunities for that. Also, if we have enough staff, it gives them an opportunity to do day reporting, which means if they see somebody that's going down the wrong road, whether with drug or alcohol problems, they can report on a regular basis at this location or to their probation and parole officer. What we really need are an opportunity for intermediate consequences. Right now, it kind of seems to boil down to either we keep you on probation and parole, even though you're kind of screwing up and there's not accountability there because you're violating provisions, or you go back to prison. There's not really an option, a good option in between. And we need those physical facilities that let someone go into an intermediate option where they can keep their job and they can stay in the community. And it's not a scorched earth start over again by putting them all the way back in prison, but it also helps hold them accountable and have some consequences, but to a level where they're not going all the way back to prison. I think we also need to rethink how we work on some of the transition. There's two key 60-day windows. The 60-day window right after they're fully released from incarceration, and there's two very important things in that 60-day window: housing and transportation for these individuals. And housing gives them that stability. Transportation is a means to look for work and to maintain employment. And traditionally, we haven't really looked at, well, maybe we provide some additional funding to pay rent for a couple of months to help them get transitioned. So that's kind of a change in thinking that I think we need to adopt. We're also doing a pilot program in Ada County, focusing on the high-risk offenders 60 days prior to them being released, where you have six reentry specialists to sit down and visit with those individuals and focus on the things that they need when they're released. Drug treatment, housing, clothing, employment, transportation. Get those things figured out before they're released, so they have those connections when they are released. We're also looking at intermediate options for release as far as community reentry centers. We have a successful one in Nampa. Representative Winter, I'm not sure if we funded the one up north yet. I hope so. And then we have one in Twin Falls that's being constructed now. And that's an opportunity, again, for them to go into the community and be able to work, but also have some more focused treatment and accountability as they're transitioning to being released. And that I think those same centers can provide that intermediate supervision opportunity that we have. Drug treatment is still a very large need and a priority, or needs to be a priority in our system. We have right now, as of in January, we have 200 inmates that are taking up beds in our prison simply waiting to get into drug treatment. If we could get them into those treatment programs and we had drug treatment, then we'd have 200 more beds that we might need for people that are supposed to be there, our more serious offenders. How am I doing on time, Mark? Oh, I'm past. Sorry. Dang. Well, I will close. As I said, I see the most opportunity for a good degree of change and improvement in our JRI in helping those that are released be successful. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Leahy. It is a privilege to introduce Representative Melissa Wintrow. Representative Wintrow is serving her third term in the Idaho legislature and represents Boise's District 19. She is a member of the Idaho Criminal Justice Commission and serves on the House Judiciary Rules and Administration Committee. Representative Wintrow has worked at 6 different universities in the past 27 years and was hired in 2000 as the first full-time Women's Center Director at Boise State University, where she created advocacy programs for survivors of sexual assault. She has brought this expertise to the Idaho legislature. Representative Wintrow earned her bachelor's degree in English literature from Miami University in Ohio and her master's degree in higher education from the University of Georgia. Please welcome Representative Wintrow.
If I go too long, just do this.
I wasn't watching Mark very well. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Oh, I have one of those. It's a real honor to be here, especially with Senator Leahy, because he has formal experience in the criminal justice system as a prosecutor. And I think what's really exceptional about our system of government is that we have a citizens' legislature. So I come as a layperson, sitting on Judiciary and Rules, the Criminal Justice Commission, Justice Reinvestment, and now the Public Defense Commission, and the Joint Finance and Appropriations Commission, committee where we just appropriated all the corrections budget. I was just looking up to see what the grand total was, but you really don't want to know right after lunch. I think Senator Leahy really covered well Justice Reinvestment, its beginnings, and really on the back end of the system, what should we be doing differently, and what should we be focusing on? Because as everybody noted, Idaho has one of the lowest crime rates, but one of the highest incarceration rates. And one of the things I'm really troubled by, in fact, based on my history, as you see, the first time I went into the women's prison in Pocatello, I asked the counselors, how many women here were first victims of physical and sexual violence? And they rolled their eyes at me. They said, oh, 95%. And so it dawns on me that there are some gender differences also as we talk about criminal justice reform. So that day I met actually with a number of women, and in particular 13 women that were incarcerated for mandatory minimum sentences for drug trafficking. And after the discussion and looking at the records, one of the women were actually selling. I met a woman whose son committed suicide and in trauma started taking medications and then turned to a drug addiction. So I met women also who had experienced pretty severe acts of physical violence, including rape. Now, what do people do when they're in trauma? They medicate. Food, alcohol, drugs, bad relationships, et cetera. So many of the women that were incarcerated first for being traumatized were now incarcerated for treating their trauma in a very negative way. And so I'm really proud, actually, that women's prison, Amanda Gentry is the warden there. She's doing an amazing job. And she is actually looking at trauma-informed care for those women living there. And clinical counselors, because if we don't get to the trauma and we're just focusing on the substance abuse, we're not going to stop the substance abuse. Now, that's a tricky wicket, because that's a really careful thing you have to do when you're incarcerated and doing trauma-informed counseling, but it is essential. So when we talk about criminal justice reform, as we talked about preparing for today, I thought, wow, that's a big net to cast, and I don't even know if some of us really understand what that means, but for me in particular, I'm looking at some of the folks in our system that have probably had fewer opportunities or have had less voice, and I'm very concerned about women and minorities who are being incarcerated, so I'll be, you know, looking further into that. But I have to say, too, when we think about criminal justice reform in our state, the Department of Corrections is doing a fairly good job. And over the past couple years, we think about reform, we see their philosophy evolving. So as our moderator, or professor, is it Cover?
Cover.
I should know that. And I said, as Professor Cover said, Idaho, like the rest of the country, is dealing with the tension of coming off a couple few decades of tough on crime. And we're trying to unravel that to think about, in addition to holding people accountable, what are the best ways to habilitate and rehabilitate folks so they come back into our communities and will be better citizens because they're living with us, right? And I can see the wrestling with that on justice reinvestment, on the Criminal Justice Commission. People are still wrestling with that tension. And in the Department of Corrections, what I've seen is a philosophy of just because you lose your liberty doesn't mean you lose your humanity. And the first time I went into a prison, how many of you have been in a prison? The first time I went in, I said everyone should go, because it was the most powerful experience I've had. I felt so dehumanized. I felt like I was in a cage with animal. I mean, I can't imagine people getting better. And so to watch the transformation in corrections, at least to normalize life more, to try to decrease that feeling of dehumanization, instituting more programs, education, even paint colors has made a difference. So we're wrestling with that. Just because you're in jail, you're going to be punished, versus maybe I better do something while folks are here to try to mitigate when they come out, so they will be more likely to transition back in. So I think that's a big part of criminal justice reform. The other part that we didn't talk about, I'm in education. Senator Lake, you really covered the coming out of prison very well. I'm thinking of upriver solutions. How do we prevent people from getting into criminal activity in the first place? What drives people to crime, especially drugs and alcohol and tobacco? Poverty, helplessness, hopelessness, right? And so I do think a good investment would be to invest in educational programs. Home visiting is a really good way, right on the ground, 0 to 3, helping families who are struggling with how to raise their kids and setting a good foundation. Early learning programs, I think, are essential. The Department of Education came and presented to our Justice Reinvestment Commission and talked about programs in schools called Sources of Strength, helping kids build community and resilience with each other so that if they're in trouble or they see somebody in trouble, they can help or they have somebody they can go to. I mean, we have to strengthen the front end to try to prevent as many people from going there as possible. And I think if somebody does get in front of a judge, we have to find ways to work more with, as the senator said, that pre-trial, pre-sentencing part. How do we help beef up misdemeanor probation and programs? And I think, too, again, leaving behind the tough-on-crime punishment and thinking more of a social work approach, a case management approach. When somebody's addicted, they don't want to stop. That takes support, enduring case management, community around them, et cetera. That's tough. I mean, I find on all these committees, we talk about all these grandiose ideas, but when you're in the trenches, this is tough work. People are complex, and the best thing we can do, in my estimation, is invest in people to help other people. So probation parole officers to help them, but also training for a more connection-based approach to get into housing and connect to jobs and relationship. Programs to meet our people helping other people. I'm way over time. I could say a lot more about that, but that's where I'll leave it.
A reminder to our radio listeners that you are listening to a City Club of Boise Forum featuring Idaho Senator Todd Lakey, Idaho Representative Melissa Wintrow, and University of Idaho College of Law Professor Aliza Cover concerning criminal justice reform and Idaho. We now will turn to questions from the audience. And we have quite a lot of questions, I think, that can be placed on this wide net idea or people to people, as you've just mentioned, Representative Wintrow. And these questions, I think, are directed to all the panelists. They have to do with how could we support families who are involved with incarceration to reduce intergenerational incarceration? And I think this may be more for the professor, but what about poverty? And is that a reason why many can't really get out of this? I think we've heard a lot about the support services that we're trying to introduce in Idaho, but sort of what are those causes and what keep people incarcerated?
Go ahead, Professor.
All right. Well, certainly, I think those are great and really important questions. I think the poverty issue is a really important one, and I think we see that partly in sort of the number of people who are represented by public defenders in this country who come into the criminal justice system. The vast majority are represented by public defenders, and that suggests that the people who are entering the system are people who lack resources to be able to hire an attorney. Mm. And so I think what Representative Wintrow was talking about in terms of investing in education, investing in support services for families in need is absolutely essential to try to give people opportunities aside from criminal behavior, aside from drug addiction, to sort of make their lives better. So absolutely, that is, it's a really important issue.
I don't have anything to add as far as the investment in our kids. I think we did a forum with Idaho Public Television, myself and Chairman Daly, when we were first new chairman of Judiciary and Rules Committee on the House and the Senate side. And one of the things they asked us was, if you could change the world and do one thing, ooh, not necessarily related to criminal justice, what would it be? And I said, improve our education system. You know, we're working on it in Idaho and making good steps on our five-year plan. But I think if you can make sure our kids have a good education, that gives them the opportunity to be successful in the future and to have hope and to have a different direction than maybe than their parents did. So supporting education, I think, helps on the front end to a large degree in reducing the impact on our prison system.
Would you like me to say a little bit more? I fully agree with what's been said here as well, and you heard me say it loud and clearly. I do think if I had the magic wand, just as Senator Lakey, I would infuse the resources early upstream with, like I said, those really positive programs that help families. I would raise wages. I would make sure that families can take care of themselves if I could do that artificially, right? I would address the housing crisis in our state. I think that's essential. As Senator said, when folks are entering and leaving, you know, having a good, stable home life is essential in pro-social behaviors. So, Upriver Solutions definitely, I think, would be helpful.
I just want to add one other thing is in terms of pretrial detention, I think this is a really important area for protecting families of people who might eventually be incarcerated or in the criminal justice system, and cash bail as well. So one of the problems with cash bail is that some people who are being accused of low-level offenses might end up being in detention for a period of time where they're not really a risk to the community. And that can have very serious consequences for the families of offenders or potential offenders, because in the meantime, somebody might lose their job, lose their housing, be unable to make rent. And so that's a moment where we could also really help families without even tackling the sort of back-end question of reentry and length of the sentence that somebody might ultimately receive.
Maybe to build off the professor's comment there, I don't know that I think we should get rid of the cash bond or the bail system that we have, but our counties are doing a pretty good job of implementing pretrial supervision. A lot of counties are struggling with the jail population. My county, Kenyon County, for example, they have a pretrial supervision program that if these individuals meet the criteria, low level, then they put them out on supervision. They can put them on electronic monitoring, have somebody check on them. There is a fee to that, but it's like $25 a month. That's better than keeping them in jail, keeps them out with their family, helps them maintain employment. So I think that's something that I see being implemented at the local level in Idaho.
Well, there's a question that's related, I think, and we haven't touched on this topic directly yet, which is mental illness. And it would be terrific if one or all three of you spoke about mental illness and how that impacts rehabilitation, how that impacts what people are able to do once they're out of prison, why they go to prison.
Do you want me to start?
Go ahead, Representative Anall.
Okay. That's only fair, right? Mm-hmm. I'm just writing the coattails of a good senator here. One thought that comes to mind in that question is in that first visit I went to the women's prison, I met with a woman who was topping out, who chose basically top out means I'm going to serve my whole sentence and I don't have supervision when I leave. And I asked her, what are you going to do after that? And it became very clear quickly that she was struggling with behavioral health and mental illness issues. And I asked the person with me, tell me about this person. And my heart was kind of breaking, thinking about what was going to happen to her. And the other thing I remember on a different visit with the chief of prisons, I said, I better not say that. Was it the chief of prison? Never mind that. But I asked her, I said, what do you think would help, really help this incarceration situation, especially as people transition out, et cetera? And she said, probably if you could expand Medicaid because more people would have services, right? And at that, I was kind of like, well, do we have... Sorry. I shouldn't have said that. But it dawns on me, again, it's about the services that we can provide folks and to make sure they do have them. So I do think when I don't have all the percentages, but we do know, and probably Senator Lake, you're the professor, has that there are folks that are in prison with substance abuse and behavioral health and mental health issues, and they actually intersect many times. So it's very complex and complicated. So I do think in our country and in our state, we have to normalize discussion about mental health. In fact, there's a really cool texting platform for schools. It's called Text Talk Act. And it's basically a texting platform where kids can talk about mental health. It's really cool. I'll tell you about it later. But I think we need to normalize that. We need to actually have enough services for folks, make sure it's not a stigma to enter service and to get treatment and to have the proper medications to help folks manage certain things that are no fault of their own. I'll leave it at that and open up.
Great comments, Representative. It's clearly something we have to deal with and focus on. One of the things that I worked on when I was a freshman legislator was helping combine substance abuse and mental health into behavioral health within our Department of Health and Welfare and treat those two things together because they're often combined. The other thing we've been focusing on in the state is our crisis centers. And those crisis centers, locating those around the state, are we up to three or four now?
Well, we funded a few more, though, but they're not on the...
Not on the books. They're not
there
yet.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to put someone that's really having behavioral health issues in jail. Our jail deputies are not trained to deal with that. It's not good for the people that are running the jail. It's not good for the individual. If we can utilize those crisis centers and get them in a facility that has professionals to help them deal with the crisis that they're going through that might otherwise result or may have resulted in a minor criminal offense, that helps everybody. And we've been working on that. I'm glad to hear we've got more coming.
Yes. So I echo much of what has been said. And certainly there is overlap between prison populations and people who have mental health issues. And when mental health issues are not adequately being dealt with in the community, we end up finding people who end up in jail or in prison because there aren't adequate services in the community, and those are the only places where they might get any services. I would also just note that mental health issues are something that affect people at all levels of the criminal justice system, from low-level drug offenders all the way up to people who are accused of capital murder. Idaho is one of only four states, I believe it is today, that don't have an insanity defense, for example, in our criminal laws. And we don't have, we potentially could have somebody who is, who would be found legally insane in another jurisdiction actually being executed in this state because we don't have a bar on executing people with mental illness, severe mental illness either. So obviously that's a very different type of situation than somebody who is sort of self-medicating and using illegal substances in order to compensate for mental health issues. But it's something that affects prisoners of all types, I would say, in our system, and something that is worth a conversation more broadly in our state.
If I could just quickly add to that. Oh, I'm sorry,
go
Senator.
Ahead. No, go ahead. I've got one more comment, too.
So the conundrum to some of this, or all of this, as I sit on the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee, is where the money comes from, right? Mm-hmm. But we do know that the mental health issue is a pervasive issue that everyone is dealing with, because we see law enforcement in particular training their officers to respond in a more social work way, I say. You know, that's probably not appropriate, but to basically how to de-escalate and figure out if there's a mental health concern, what else I can do. And the crisis centers are a great place for that. The first time I visited there, there were two officers that brought somebody there, two people that were struggling. But that is a telltale sign, and I'm glad to see that we're doing more training in that kind of community-based policing way. But Ada County Sheriff in particular, I think, is doing a great job. And I know Boise City Police has been really trying to work on that, too.
One other follow-up, if I might, on that, Representative. Professor Cover's comments reminded me, one of the other things that we put in place is a local behavioral health board that is comprised of county commissioners, local law enforcement from city and county, Department of Health and Welfare folks, treatment providers, to help identify and fund additional behavioral health programs in their communities. And I think it's important that those are at the local level, because they're most familiar, the people involved in the community are most familiar with the people in their community and where to be able to provide services most effectively. So I think that was an important component of that behavioral health system.
Well, I'm going to shift gears a little bit. We have 10 questions that are almost identical.
Ooh.
And they're directed to Senator Leahy. And I'm going to read one that was the I think captured everyone's question very well. Mandatory minimum reform passed through committee this week. So that passed through House committee this week. And it likely will pass the full House. It will then land in your committee. Given that multiple Supreme Court judges, attorneys general, and other judges testified in favor of the bill, will you allow your fellow elected legislators to vote on a bill that will give our elected judges discretion when it comes to sentencing drug crimes? Or will you kill it in committee?
Well, good question. I thought it might be coming.
You all must be House members.
Yeah. I appreciate the question. I will not be having a hearing.
And there were 10 of them, by the way.
Yes. Okay. And I've gotten a few emails. I will not be having a hearing on that issue. I listen to lots of people on this issue. And, you know, the parents of people that are involved, the criminal defendants themselves, also law enforcement that deals with this on the street on a regular basis. And I guess they're the ones that are the most telling for me, and listening to how they describe it. We have drug deals in Idaho that are not being done here because of the fact that we have those in place. We don't hear about, we have mandatory minimums for marijuana. If you have a pound of a marijuana, which is somewhere between 900 and 1,000 joints worth, that's a one-year mandatory minimum. Cocaine is 28 grams. That's somewhere in the neighborhood of 96 doses. And that's about that's a three-year mandatory minimum. Meth is the same. Meth is our number one problem. Heroin is what we hear about. And heroin is the worst of the worst. Right now, that's pretty low. It's at 2 grams for our mandatory minimum, which a gram has about 10 doses in it. It's called a point. And so that's 20 doses. As I visit with the law enforcement officers, those that are in possession of 2 grams are dealing still. I have more sympathy, I should say, for those that are truly personal users. Those that are dealing, I have a lot less sympathy for. And to be able to obtain 2 grams, you have to have built relationships over time with the dealers that are above you. But that said, as I visit with them also, the 2 gram limit is probably the lower end of those that are dealing. I've proposed a compromise. Rather than keeping the status quo, which is something I don't necessarily think is appropriate either, is to up the minimum quantity to 5 grams. So that would be essentially 50 doses of heroin, and also reduce the time frames involved. It's a tough issue. It's really hard to hear about folks whose family members are in prison. For 3 years is the minimum for that heroin level, but it's harder for me to listen to the parent whose son overdosed because somebody sold them 1 or 2 points of heroin and they're dead. So that's where I'm coming from.
Thank you, Senator.
Long answer.
This question, I think, is quite interesting because it has to do with rural Idaho and urban Idaho. And I would just like to broaden this question to talk about rural United States and urban United States. And the question is, are rural areas more impacted than urban areas with respect to incarceration and so forth? So I don't know, Professor Cover, if this has come up in your research, if there's a difference or similarity.
So I certainly think there are differences in the way that incarceration affects people in rural communities versus urban communities. One issue that I think arises here in Idaho is just, again, provision of public defender services in rural communities. That can be an enormous challenge because there are very few people, and the public defenders need to travel very long distances. People might eventually be, if they are incarcerated, might be incarcerated some distance from their family, which makes things very challenging. So just resources in a lot of rural areas may pose challenges. Of course, there are other types of issues that arise in urban settings that are equally difficult, but perhaps a little different, and certainly some of the racial issues that we see in the criminal justice system and problems with policing and relationships between communities of color and police are perhaps exacerbated in some urban settings. But there also have been various reform efforts in some urban environments, which it's hard to speak, I think, uniformly about incarceration that affects urban communities versus rural communities. But I do think that there are unique challenges in both of those settings. And certainly, I would love to hear from the senator and representative about how Idaho is dealing in particular with the challenges for rural communities here.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know. That's really interesting to me because I don't have a lot of data on the rural issue, but I do want to give you some stats. Today, the daily count today for Idaho of inmate population for state prisons is 8,744 total. So 695 are out of state, 569 are in county jails, and there are 426 in the CAP facility. Now, felony probation and parole, just felony probation parole, not misdemeanor, 16,602 people. Of that 16,000, 7,400, almost half of them, are here in Canyon and Ada County, mainly because where our prisons are probably located, where people transition out. But, I mean, that to me is a when I see those numbers, I'm thinking of resources for this area and how are we in this very big region, urban setting, what kind of resources are available as people transition outward and into the community, and where can they go? That's a real resource drain if we don't have enough here. So I know a lot of times, as an urban legislator, I fight hard for my rural neighbors. I fought hard in JFAC for a program for my rural doctors recently. But we need to have resources in urban centers to help folks transition successfully, I think. So especially in housing, as the senator said, and transportation. And we don't have public transportation here. We have those scooters in Boise on the sidewalks, to much of my chagrin. But, I mean, those are real resource issues that impact people in urban settings when they're transitioning.
I don't know if we really have good data on urban versus rural crime levels or number of people that are committed. Certainly the highest demand, like anything else, is in your population centers as far as the number of people that you need to serve. But I think those things that we talked about, driving services down to the local level for behavioral health and crisis centers being located throughout the state instead of just in the Treasure Valley, will help with some of those things. But I don't know if I really have a good feel on the difference between urban and rural.
And I'm going to get a little political here. The resource issue is a complex one, right? Because if we put things at a local level, which we like to do, that means that's a funding resource issue for the citizens in that county. And we currently have a statute that says, hey, you can't raise your budget more than 3% any given year. And in Ada County, like my county, we see property assessments going through the roof. We see a lot of property coming off the tax rolls, hospitals, churches, Hewlett-Packard, right? And what does that do? It drives the responsibility onto the property owner in that 3%. So then if we do want to drive things in that county level, how do we make sure we're not stressing the county and upping our property taxes to pay for those? And what role can the state play in that, whether that's policy decisions to untie hands for local decision-making, local option tax, these kinds of things to help our local communities. But I do think that is a thing that has to be addressed when we're talking about all these big resources, is what is a state, city, county responsibilities in all of them, and how do we appropriately support each other while we do that?
And I, Representative Wintrow, follow up on that. I agree with you.
Maybe we should be on committee together.
Yeah, my local government background, I hated getting mandates from the state that were unfunded. So we need to be very cognizant of that. I see more of that cooperative relationship being voluntary, but we have to be sensitive to their levy caps. I think local option's a great thing. So that's a good point.
Right, because as we talk about these crisis centers, JFAC has funded the initial startup and then said, hey, in 2 years you have to come back with a plan about how you're going to fund it. So that means the county, cities, whoever has to come together and try to fund that. Now, we're going to be in a real problem if they can't get it funded, right? Now, what's the state going to do? Are we going to cut them off? Or are we going to try to find some other solutions? But that's the reality.
So we are getting short of time, and the list of questions is getting longer. So we're going to try to move through them in more of a lightning style. So this one has to do with the cost. We haven't heard numbers yet, either national, state, Idaho in particular.
Our JFAC members pulling up the
I'm getting the budget.
Spreadsheet.
Oh, God. When you cite cost, you want to know, like, like the Department of Corrections budget this year, their operating budget, the governor's recommendation, so pretty much it's close to what we allocated for $282,441,700.
And what percentage is that of the overall budget?
Like 4%? No, it's more than that.
I think I saw a statistic of about 7.8%, something
right.
like that. Although I'm not sure if that's limited to Department of Corrections budget. I mean, certainly one of the issues in terms of trying to capture how much money this costs is that there's not just one institutional actor here. So there's the cost of incarceration itself, but there's also the cost right. of prosecutors' offices and police departments and public defenders' offices, and it's very spread out. And I think one of the challenges with having internalized consequences for different actors within the system in terms of the costs of mass incarceration are that no single department of the government is responsible for the full cost. Mm-hmm. And so there's the sheriffs or the prisons can incarcerate a large number of people. They feel that cost. The prosecutors don't necessarily feel the cost of incarceration because that's not their budget. The city might, cities might feel different costs. So nobody feels the full cost. It's diffuse throughout the system.
And I would just add there, too, that doesn't even take into account, for example, the state of Idaho. I think we're one of the few states that don't really put any state funding into victim services. So all the shelters throughout the state and all the community-based programs, those are all federally funded. Now, the Violence Against Women Act was Senator Crapo actually has been the lead sponsor on that. And after the government shut down, it hasn't been reinstated yet. It will be. But that drew a question to us in JFAC, like what happens if it doesn't? And the director of the Council for Domestic Violence and Victim Assistance said, well, all that money would go away. And I said, where does it go? All the community-based programs, all the shelters, all those victim services programs. Mm-hmm. So that's a big cost, and that's millions of dollars.
The other aspect of that, we touched on it just very superficially, briefly earlier, public defense. We have been actively trying to reform that system in Idaho. It's historically, since time began, been part of the responsibilities of the counties. As they run the courts, they also handle the public defense system. And we started a few years ago to make some changes as far as the types of contracts. You can't have a flat fee contract. You have to pay hourly now, so the incentive isn't to just run cases through. And they have to be present at certain stages. And then we just adopted caseload and workload standards. But those things come with a cost. The state's been funding a grant program to the counties for about five and six million. We just added another $5 to $6 million because of those standards that we just adopted that are, again, being borne by the county as they implement those systems. But we're not done there. We need to continue to watch that and see how those standards work, make sure we're providing a constitutional defense system to help these people and that we're not putting that burden on the counties.
Right.
Thank you. Well, there are some great questions coming in from students, and I'm going to combine two of them. One is, what do you think is the best way to incentivize offenders to improve their probation efforts? And I'm going to couple it with this other question, which is, why is all of this change taking so long? Why has it taken a generation for a major reform?
Professor, that sounds like a cerebral question.
I think the problems are really big, and the scope of the system is really big. So I think it would be surprising if this type of change happened extremely quickly. I think we are in a different mindset right now than we were 40 years ago, and so it's possible that change will happen more quickly from here, but it is difficult to keep track of all of the potential entry points for reform in the system. And I think the problems of there are problems of incarceration. There are also, of course, problems of public safety and concerns about that are very legitimate. it's hard to know how to deal with some of these difficult problems and how to deal with, you know, some drug addiction, things like that. I don't think that we've been dealing with them terribly effectively through our criminal justice system, but it's hard to know what a good solution is given budgetary constraints. And I think money is a key problem here in terms of creating change quickly. But I think there's hope that we might see some progress on this issue in the near future. I don't know that I have an answer to how to, how to help people to make parole effective. I'm not sure that I'm qualified to give that answer.
Part of the challenge you face as a legislator is everybody has their priority, and it's the highest priority. Whether it's education or it's transportation or it's the prison system, you name it, and there's limited funds to go around. And trying to find the right balance in how to spend that money is a real challenge. I think that's why change is perhaps slow, because we need to be able to fund lots of things adequately. At the probation and parole level, I think it's that contact and regular communication with your probation and parole officer that they can provide you certain incentives and disincentives, but try to help manage and help that person be successful before they get too far off track and then they're back in the system. So regular contact and communication helps them correct those minor deviations. They may be going off track and they can help bring them around, versus not having enough staff and they get further and further off track and then they're back in the system again. So I think it's changing how we approach it and making sure we have adequate officers out there to help.
And I would just add, as quickly as I can, is that I think change can happen slowly or it can be revolutionary. It can be in a lightning bolt. We see that. Now, I think sometimes we forget that this system is in a larger social system that has a history in our country. And if you haven't read The New Jim Crow, I think you should, that you cannot take out issues of race, class, and so forth as they intersect with the criminal justice system and what was and how we have infused those resources there. It does take political will to change the system, but I do think in each state legislature, when we have a party system that is more balanced and different philosophies, we may come to different conclusions quicker. But I do think I think this is the only place in the whole lecture I'm diverting from the senator, is that I do think the resources are there. They are choices that we make as a society in our state about where we put those resources and how much. And that's reflected in all kinds of policy decisions that include tax policy and how we spend money. And so I do think the reason it's so slow is because we have different political philosophies of how to do it, and those are in tension. But that's the political process, isn't it? But emphasizing, we cannot take out the discussion about race, and when people are disenfranchised and locked up at a higher rate, they don't have a voice to say something. And so their voice doesn't count as desperately as some of the rest of us. So I think we cannot and we must examine that more fully.
Okay, this will be the last question. And this really has to do with how people can learn more about this. Is there a way that you can find information about the JRI, more information about cash bail alternatives? So if each of you could take maybe 15 or 20 seconds to just say your number one or number two place for people to learn more.
Well, start with Google. Google JRI Idaho, and it'll pull up the Department of Corrections website, and they have various links on JRI. They have anything from a description of the matrices to the kind of frequently asked questions, those kind of things. And then it's just kind of keep your finger on the local with your local legislator, stay in communication with them, because we are addressing aspects of those issues every year.
There are a lot of wonderful organizations out there that are doing great work on criminal justice reform issues. Nationally, some of them are the Brennan Center, the Vera Institute for Justice. You can look up those types of organizations. We also have local organizations like the ACLU of Idaho that are doing great work on these issues. So I think just getting a sense of what organizations are out there, and a lot of those organizations are also happy to talk to people if they have specific questions.
All right. On behalf of City Club of Boise, we are pleased to provide you with one of our highly collectible coffee mugs. Please join me in thanking Senator Leahy, Representative Wintrow, and Professor Cover for participating in today's forum.
Thank you, Senator. It is an honor.
You have been listening to the City Club of Boise, a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club Forum is the second annual Marilyn Schuler Forum on Human Rights, honoring Idaho Senator Cherie Buckner Webb, which will take place on Tuesday, April 23rd at the Grove Hotel in downtown Boise. Find on-demand audio of this and other forums, learn about becoming a member, and see a schedule of upcoming events at cityclubofboise.org. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.